This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
All right, here we are again, back with more radio for your consideration. Thanks for your interest. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We have more for you on our website, RedIceCreations.com. Today we're talking with Richard Cassaro. He's a journalist, speaker, Freemason, and author of Written in Stone, Decoding the Secret Masonic Religion Hidden in Gothic Cathedrals and World Architecture. The book uncovers a lost wisdom tradition that was practiced globally in antiquity, found memorialized in pyramids, triptychs, and identical images worldwide. The central tenets of this tradition have been perpetuated in Western secret societies. The most visible of these is the so-called Masonic Fraternity, and according to Richard, age-old order, whose ranks have included Europe's Gothic cathedral builders and, as we know, America's founding fathers. Today we're going to go deep into the concept of the triptych, something Richard has found evidence for around the world, and what this architectural secret symbolism means. We're also going to discuss operative masonry versus speculative Freemasonry and the significant difference between them. Welcome, Richard. It's good to have you with us today. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio with us here.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Now, you have a few different titles out there right now. Well, it's one primarily. You're about to release an ebook, and we'll obviously want to get into that a little bit later, talk more about these titles. But just to, I guess briefly talk about your interest overall in these topics, what we're going to discuss here today. Maybe we can just kind of begin to address how you got involved and how you developed an interest in some of the things, such as masonry, architecture, and ancient civilization, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, it all started with the pyramids, and I've always, ever since I was a very, very young boy of probably 6 or 7 years old, I was always fascinated by pyramids, and I was also, you know, as I grew a little bit older, was fascinated by the fact that there's pyramids all over the ancient world, and luckily for me, I had a mother who, you know, understood all this type of stuff and the mystery of it, and she kind of encouraged me to study this type of stuff, and I really, you know, because I was so fascinated and I kind of excelled and started to learn not just pyramids, but there's a lot of similarities between all of these ancient civilizations. And it started to progress from there, finding all the similarities, asking, you know, why do these similarities exist? What does it mean? Why aren't modern scholars examining the similarities or taking them seriously? Similar to the way in which the Victorian scholars studied them, examined them, and took them very seriously. Is there something going on? And it sort of started to progress from there.
Indeed. How important has Freemasonry been in your work so far, Richard?
You know, Freemasonry is just confirmation for me. You know, one of the things that I discovered, and this was, many years ago, is the triptych, the concept that all the pyramid cultures all built the same temples, all built the same what I call triptych temples, which is, the three doors with the door in the middle being wider and taller than the outer two. When I discovered that, I knew I was onto something big, and shortly thereafter I learned that there was such a thing called the Freemasons. I learned that a lot of their imagery and a lot of their symbolism is taken from ancient cultures all around the world, not just the Egyptians and not just the Babylonians. And so I knew that there was something in there for me, and I knew that whatever masonry was, it was calling me. It was saying to me, listen, this is where you should be here, because they had the triptych, and that's something that I found, and I knew I was in the right place.
Right, really good. A little bit later, I want to go into some of the critique, I guess, of Freemasonry, talk about some of the other information out there and how you perceive that. As you told me earlier, you joined Freemasonry about 10 years ago, so we can discuss that later. But why don't we kind of lay the groundwork first in some of the things that you found? So let's just kind of head straight into the triptych and just describe to us what that is, how you stumbled upon it, and what the deeper significance of that is.
Okay. Long, long ago, I'm 40 years old now, so we're talking about 20 years, something like that. You know, I was just fascinated by all these similarities in ancient cultures all around the world. And every time I went to a museum or I went to speak with a scholar or whoever it would be, a historian, I always brought up the similarities, and I was always kind of gently patted down and told, you're on the wrong track. Don't study that stuff. It's not really important. You know, people in the past believed that there was a connection. Maybe there was an Atlantis type of civilization, that a mother culture that died long ago, and that all the world's first cultures or first known cultures were children of this mother culture. But scholars today don't even believe that anymore, and it's not a good avenue to study, and that type of stuff. And I was always fascinated with that type of stuff. And I went, you know, traveling to search for more evidence, because I was convinced at a very young age that that's the truth, that there is a reason why all the first cultures built pyramids. There's a reason why all the first cultures had solar symbolism. Many of them created mummies. The concept of life after death and the belief in the soul is pretty much universal with all these cultures, and a lot more similarities than that. So, you know, I went on an adventure, and very quickly I found exactly what I was looking for. I found that all of these pyramid cultures all built the same temples. And how it's not been, you know, discovered before, I was, you know, at a loss to explain, because to me it was so obvious. And if you look on my website and you look at the book and you look at the work, I show images, I show photos, I show scientific proof that the triptych was everywhere. And, you know, for example, the Mayan cultures, you know, it's not just one or two triptychs. You know, they have dozens and dozens of triptych temples. And we're talking about ruins. You know, we're not talking about something, you know, imagine how many they really built. That's just the ruins, that's what's left of their civilization.
Yeah.
So, you know, the concept of the triptych, for me, what I slowly learned was it's a symbol that all the ancient pyramid cultures built triptychs. And little by little, I learned that it symbolized the same religion, the same spiritual wisdom for all the cultures. In other words, the Mayans built triptychs, the Egyptians built triptychs, and all the ancient cultures pretty much that built pyramids all built triptychs for the same reason. The triptych has the same meaning all around the ancient world. And in a nutshell, it's pretty much explains the difference between your physical self and your spiritual self. Your physical self with a lowercase s, the animal you, the part of you that is flesh and blood that will live only a short time and that will soon die. And the spiritual you, the capital S self, the part of you that is eternal, that was never born and that will never die. And the idea of the triptych is basically an explanation of who you are, where you came from, where you're going, and what life is about. And pretty much it's the outer two doors of the triptych stand for the pairs of opposites, the sun and the moon, the light and the dark, the left and the right. And the inner door is the center, is your balance point, is your spiritual you, the transcendent you, the capital S you, the part of you that doesn't take part in the duality of the material world, because you're older than duality. You transcend duality. The real you, the capital S self you, you transcend duality. And the idea of the triptych is to help you find your center, help you find that balance point, and help you discover who you really are.
So if we were looking at one, how would we recognize it? We could be talking about a window configuration, a door configuration with two smaller on the side of a larger one at the center, correct?
That's exactly right. The one in the center can be taller. It's not always taller, but it's usually wider. It usually has some kind of an emphasis on it. And the two on the opposite, the two flanking the center door, are usually spaced equally apart and are usually spaced in such a way as they look like opposites, whereas the one in the center is obviously in the center. Where the Freemasons came in for me was, one of the things that I've always been attracted to ever since I was a kid is Gothic cathedrals. I still am fascinated by them, and I think they're the most, you know, they're the coolest, the most mysterious, the most profound monuments, some of the most profound monuments on the face of the earth, especially the, you know, the Gothic cathedrals, most of which were built in Northern Europe. And I realized that a lot of these, the entrances to the Gothic cathedrals had triptychs. And slowly I started to understand that the Freemasons, the operative Freemasons, the builders, created these Gothic cathedrals, built triptychs at the entrances, and did so because not only did they understand the ancient worldwide triptych religion, but they built these Gothic cathedrals as a landmark, as a preservation in stone of the ancient worldwide universal religion. So that you'll see triptychs in Gothic cathedrals, and the entire facade and the entire shape of the cathedral is an explanation and a revelation of what the triptych wisdom is.
Have you found the same one on most lodges that you've been looking at?
Also, yeah, in you know, a lot of these secret societies, like the Freemasons and other secret societies as well that have kind of spun off from the Freemasons, like the Pythians, like the Knights of Pythias, even the Skull and Bones, and other secret societies like the Oddfellows. A lot of them, a lot of their lodges and temples have triptych entrances, and you know that's because these secret societies were founded. To preserve the ancient wisdom tradition. Now, is that what they're here for today? No, they have a different purpose today. They've digressed. There's a problem. The wires have been played with. The wires have been messed with. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong today, and that's happened probably a couple of hundred years ago. But the creation of these secret societies was originally for a very good purpose. And you got to remember that, you know, Europe, we're talking about Europe and Christianity. Christianity ruled over Europe. And, you know, you couldn't really talk against Christianity. So there had to be a way to safely relay the ancient universal religion down the ages. And that's what the secret societies were for. They existed to perpetuate the ancient knowledge. They existed to perpetuate what was once a very fantastic universal religion, a religion of truth, a spiritual wisdom of truth that's as applicable to our own lives today as it was to the ancients. And that's what secret societies were about. That's why secret societies have triptych facades. That's why the Freemasons and a lot of their lodges and a lot of their buildings built triptychs at their entrances. And Gothic cathedrals have triptych facades. It's all a continuation of the ancient wisdom.
Very interesting. Now, a little bit later, I want to talk about this, how things got sidetracked. Something has gone wrong, you said. We'll return to that later. But let's zoom in a little bit more on the parent culture then, if you will. I want to ask you a little bit about how advanced you think that it was, and if it was a global civilization, and what some of the what they've helped us to bring, basically, some of the things that we can see in our world today.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's really something that I honestly have no idea. It's something that I just have no idea about. I feel like there was something there. I follow Plato. I follow the classical historians. They spoke about Atlantis. They spoke about a continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and that sank into the sea, or that was destroyed by a flood. And the concept of a flood is very important because all the first known cultures all have that flood myth. So to me, the concept of a flood, which is common to all the first cultures, is relatable, is explaining what happened to Atlantis, is explaining to what happened to this mother culture. And I relate it as a golden age civilization. In other words, Atlantis was a mother culture. It was very highly advanced, and I don't necessarily mean technologically advanced. I mean, they understood what life was about. They understood the concept of spirituality, the difference between the physical body and the spiritual self that I discussed earlier. And life for them was an initiation into this wisdom. I think that Atlantis existed during what the ancients called the Golden Age. And if you follow, classical authors and historians like Hesiod and Ovid, you'll know that they talked about different ages of men. And it all started with the Golden Age. Hesiod talks about five ages, the Golden Age, starting with the Golden Age, and then coming down from the Silver, and then the Bronze, and the Heroic, and the Iron Age. Ovid also similarly talks about ages, where it started with the Golden Age, and then there was the Silver and Bronze, and then the Iron Age. And in the Hindu Vedic ages, or the Yugas, what they're called, we have the same type of idea. And many people say that today we're living in the Kali Yuga age, which is the worst one of all. And so what you have here is the concept of a general digression. And that's the exact opposite of what scholars and historians and people today believe. They believe that we started out in the Stone Age, and little by little things have gotten better and better, and now here we are today with this fantastically sophisticated culture. No, I believe the exact opposite. There was once a fantastically sophisticated culture, and little by little we've digressed, and today we're in sheer darkness compared to what the ancients of the Golden Age culture, you know, the type of civilization that they lived in, and the love that they had for each other, and the wisdom that marked their day-to-day existence.
So you don't measure advancement by how detailed and quick our iPads are. You're talking about something completely different here, an understanding of life and nature, human relationships, and also the fact that we seem to have a different attitude towards life overall in the past. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I feel that, you know, they understood mysteries of the mind like we don't today. They understood how to explain what a human being is, not just on a spiritual but on a physical level. They understood concepts of astronomy and the pulls that the gravitational pulls that the different planets have on us and that type of stuff. And you know, when you are exposed to this and when you have this type of information, you know, it signals a much more advanced society than we are today, where, you know, if the iPad doesn't work, you bang it and you throw it against the wall because you're so angry. I mean, you're weak. We're weak to do that. We're a weak people. I see us today as being very weak. We don't control our emotions. We're barbaric. We have wars. We destroy each other. We control each other. I see a very bad world out there. And when I look to antiquity, I don't see that at all. I see a much higher wisdom at work there.
And there is a conflict in history here, because what we hear in some instances, and again, depends on where you turn to get your information. As always, there's always contradictory data out there. But we hear that the pagans were the ones who were barbaric, involved in human sacrifice. And thank God that Christianity arrived on the scene that saved us from all this, right?
Yeah, that's what we're taught. You know, it's exactly what we're taught, you know, exactly that the pagans were animalistic and you know, practicing witchcraft, and the nature religions. We sort of have this, you know, looking down, thumbing our noses down at the nature religions as if they were something beneath us. And I think that the exact opposite is true. You know, once you separate yourself from nature, you're sort of a head without a body. And you're cutting yourself off from who you really are. A lot of these pagan traditions and a lot of the ancient religions, you know, they told you the answers will be found in nature. Look to nature to find the answers and to find who you are. And that's something that we've distanced ourselves from today. And I think we've had a little help from an unseen, invisible college that doesn't really want us to find ourselves, that doesn't really want us to know who we are, because then it's going to be harder to control us. In order to be able to control us, they need us to be scared. They need us to look for answers. They need us to be, in fear all the time. And that's the way we buy their products, and that's the way we buy into their constant messages of who we are and what we need to purchase in order to know who we are, and you know, what type of politics we need to buy into, and all that type of stuff. So I think we've had a little help in the wrong way.
Definitely. Definitely. We'll go into that a little bit later here. Now, to me, Richard, it seems like at least one stage, if you will, of this digression, degradation that you mentioned before. It seems like that began in association with a major catastrophe or a flood that you referred to. We might be talking about several here, but we know that at least one major one seemed to have taken place at some stage in the past. And this seems to have been a problematic incident, because of our relationship changed to nature. But there are some who suggest that that this degradation began before that there was something within society. If we talk about Atlantis, for example, as a high civilization, there's some information that indicates that they became corrupt, basically, at one stage, and then a little bit later a catastrophe or a flood happened. What do you think about that?
I think exactly what Plato said was correct. And what Plato said when he discussed Atlantis was, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but he pretty much said that when they ceased to identify with the divine element in themselves, and when they started more to identify with their human nature, with their animal nature, little by little, that caused the downfall. And there's a lot of wisdom in there. I mean, first of all, it teaches that, you know, we have divinity within us. We have eternity within us. We have spirituality within us. We don't need to you know, subscribe to a modern religion in order to find that. So, you know, that's just one of the many ideas that Plato speaks to. But you know, he makes it pretty clear that the reason for the downfall was that they ceased. I think that he says something like they ceased to carry their prosperity with moderation, or something like this. They stopped focusing on the divinity within themselves, and they started to get more greedy. They started to get more lustful. They started to identify more and more with the material world rather than with the transcendent element within them, which is who they really are. So they lost sight of who they are. They lost the balance point. They lost the centeredness, and that in some way translated to the catastrophe that, you know, that that we talk about as the flood and as the destruction of the continent.
And so yet this is the basic message of the symbol itself, the importance of balance between the dichotomy of everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's part of it. Yep, a very strong part of it. That's the, you know, one of the main messages of it is don't identify with the duality. Don't identify with the good and the bad. That's, you know, that's part of the world, and it's an important part of the world, but that's not who you are. You're something deeper. You're something more ancient. You're something more eternal. And you're something much, much more profound than that. And they started to identify with the opposites, whereas the lesson is to find the center and transcend the opposites. There's a sun and a moon element in this, and I think that that's really important for to understand what the triptych is. One side of the opposite. There's two doors on the outside of the triptych. The right door, when you're looking at the triptych, the one on the left, but it's actually the right door, is the door of the sun, and the left door is the door of the moon. And that's the sun and the moon are used in Freemasonry and used in a lot of other systems, both ancient and modern. And there's a reason, and that's because the sun and the moon symbolize all the pairs of opposites in the world. You have the sun and the moon. They stand for day and night, obviously, which we perceive as opposites. The sun is out and it's warm during the day, and the moon is out and it's cold at night. During the day, things are usually dry because the sun is out, and at night, things are moist. So you have the opposites of dry and moist, and obviously light and dark. And so the concept of the sun and the moon are really, really important here. The right side of the triptych, the right-hand door of the triptych, is identified with the sun and the male, and the left door of the triptych is the moon and the female. And again, you know, the idea is not to identify with male or female or right or wrong or sun and moon. It's to find that center point and realize that, you know, you can balance the two, and you need to balance the two. And in a sense also that you're the creator of all of this. You're the source. Don't go looking for the source in the Bible or some kind of a holy book. You are the source. You are the center point of the triptych, and you are the deity, the eternal soul, the God within, in the center point of the triptych. There's a triptych in the Last Supper, right behind Jesus in the middle. In fact, I think the entire Last Supper is all about the triptych. It has nothing really to do with Jesus. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Last Supper, you have Christ in the center door of the triptych, and then you have the two outer doors. You have six disciples on either side explaining the concept of balance. And the idea with Christ being in the middle is, you know, when you put your mind in the middle, you're aligning yourself with that Christ consciousness, or with that Buddha consciousness, with that eternal divine self, that capital S you part. And that's the message of the Last Supper, which is, you know, identify with the middle. That's who you really are. Don't identify with the, you know, with the right side or the left side.
Yeah, it's a good point. Now, how far back do we need to go, do you think, to begin to maybe come closer to the origins of this knowledge? Again, then, just to reemphasize this, we know that there's been a destruction. So the buildings that we see today, including the pyramids and everything else that that are part, if you will, of this ancient system. We don't know if that's the first generation, first version of this. There might have been several more, but they've all been destroyed. But what do you think? How far back do we need to go to begin to get closer to the origin point of all this?
Yeah, I find it in the earliest buildings. You know, usually when we think of ancient civilizations, most of us think of ancient Egypt. It's probably one of the, if not the oldest cultures on Earth. And, you know, scholars are always finding one that's older and that type of stuff. And that's going to keep going back and forth for decades. But, you know, the ancient Egyptians built a lot of triptych temples. And almost all the time, the Aten symbol, you know, the sun disk with the twin serpents issuing from either side and the wings, that's always on the top of the center door of the triptych. And that's a symbol of the perfected soul and the soul that's been able to, you know, strike that balance of opposites. The two serpents are symbolic of that, as well as the wings. And even on an up and down level, you have, you know, the wings of the Aten symbolizing something very high up and a spiritual transcendence. And whereas the twin serpents, you know, when they're two like that, one's looking to the left and one's looking to the right, they're, you know, they're symbolic of duality. Serpent is something that crawls on the ground as opposed to wings, which are high up in the air. So, and then of course, a circle with no beginning and no end is a symbol of eternity, and a symbol of the soul, the perfected soul. So, you know, in some of the most ancient temples of Egypt, there's triptychs, and on these triptychs and above the center door is this Aten symbol, which is telling us, you know, this is the concept of the balance of opposites to find the soul within. So, you know, it's as old as civilization goes.
Yeah, in a world today that is so incredibly polarized and again focused on the left wing of this animal or the right wing of that animal, it's a really important lesson to be able to, well, both transcend that, of course, but understand that there is a unity in the opposites, if you will, and that they both hold something which is of value, and that we need to find balance between these sides, basically.
That's right. I love it. You said it perfectly. You know, that's exactly it. There's a unity in the opposites. I like to think of it as the yin-yang symbol, you know, the Tao. You are, it's a symbol of you. Everything, by the way, I mean, I, you know, one of the reasons people ask me, have you heard of this research or that research? I really don't. I'm really not interested. I find that a lot of people are not focused on the right things. All of this stuff, the ancient Egyptians, the Mayans, all the wisdom traditions of the ages, paganism, and a lot of the secret societies like the Masons and stuff, the myths, everything is about you. It's about teaching you who you are, teaching you what life is about. You know, it's there to teach us. And a lot of people I don't see, you know, talking about this stuff. And to me, this is the most important thing. You know, this is, you know, this type of stuff for me unites everything that I'm interested in. I'm interested in all the ancient civilizations. I'm interested in all their wisdom. I'm interested in all the similarities between these ancient civilizations. I'm interested in the Greek philosophers and in Hinduism because Hinduism is the oldest living religion. And I'm interested in the secret societies because I know that they exist as a continuation of this wisdom. So I don't see anybody else really talking about all this stuff. And you know, this is important to me because it's touching on all the stuff I'm interested in. But the, you know, getting back to the Tao, for me, the yin-yang symbol, that's a symbol of us. You know, people see the yin and the yang and they say, well, it's a concept of opposites. But it's more than that. There's actually a third element in play, which is the circle. The circle which, you know, encompasses both opposites. The symbol of the yin-yang is a symbol of who you are. The circle is a symbol of your eternal soul. It has no beginning and no end. And the yin and the yang are a symbol of the opposites, which is your physical self, the left side of your body and the right side of your body, which one side is male and the other side is female. One side is solar, the other side is lunar. And you'll remember from cartoons when we were a kid, you'd have the evil demon telling you on the left side, telling you to do bad and tempting you to do bad things, and the good angel on your right side telling you to do good things. And that's just the same concept at play here. You are a yin-yang. You are the Tao. You are an eternal being. You've manifested the opposites. You've manifested your body, just like a snail creates its own shell, and to live in the material world. And you won't be here for long, but when you do die, you'll go back to that eternal Tao, that circle, which is who you are.
And you've traveled quite a bit as well, and to be able to see much of this for yourself in the temples and everything else, correct?
Yeah, I mean, traveling is the best thing in the world. It just opens you up to so much. I have friends that grew up in New York with me, who are, you know, Italian and Irish and things like that, saying, you know, why aren't you Christian? Why, you know, what is all this about? And, you know, now they understand. But, you know, having not really been exposed to too much else, they're, you know, focused on what they're taught. And, you know, as you know, people are taught different things in different parts of the world. The people in the Middle East wouldn't even think of, many people in the Middle East wouldn't even think of converting from Islam. You know, people in Christian lands don't understand how people can reject Christ. So, you know, traveling really opens up so many doors and you know, it expands your horizons.
Definitely.
Opens your mind.
Yeah. Now, one of the biggest no-nos is what you said before. It's to begin to point at the similarities between these seemingly different cultures. And this gets into the topic of transcultural diffusion, which I'm a believer of myself as well. And the question is, of course, how they, if there was a one source, as we talked about so far, that is the origins of everything, or if there was communication with basically a travel. But in one of your articles, Richard, you basically point out the incredible similarities in the cultural cultures of the Egyptians and the pre-Incas or the Mayans or on the South American side, we should say. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I'm just fascinated with, and all the time I'm finding more and more. And I'll give you one that probably I'm just really hitting on right now that I'm going to be talking about in the new book, The Secret of the Circle, that I'm writing right now. You know, if you think about the Aten symbol, many people know it as the circumpunct. It's the hieroglyphic symbol is a circle with a dot in the center. And that's a symbol of the self, the higher self, which is who we are. The Aztec calendar stone has the same exact, it's the same exact symbol. It's a circle and it has a dot in the center. And in the middle of that is the sun god, is a face of the sun god, actually. See, it's the same exact symbol, and as I'm learning now and I'm digging more and more into it, it means the same exact thing. It's an emblem of who we are. As I said earlier, it's explaining the difference between our higher self, the soul within who we are, the true self, the true, you know, God within, which is who we are, and the physical animal self. So, you know, finding the similarities, like I have the latest article up on the website, which explains the similarities between the pre-Inca and Inca civilizations in Peru and the ancient Egyptian civilization. These two cultures are twin civilizations. And I would dare any scholar to debate me live on any program on television or in any forum, and I can prove it. It's so easy because there's so many similarities. And most importantly is, you know, all these similarities point to the same wisdom tradition, to the same religion that was held and celebrated by both cultures. And that's, to me, the light at the end of the tunnel. Why show all these similarities? Well, I show them because I'm interested in them, because they point to a universal religion that wasn't just held by the pre-Inca, Inca, and Egyptian civilizations, but by all the ancient cultures, the Chinese, the Hindus, the Babylonians, all of them. And if I had the time and the resources and the money, I would be a lot further along than I am now. Not complaining, because I'm very happy, you know, to be where I am and to be on the track that I'm on. But there's just so much more out there, and it's a shock. It's really a shock how scholars are just, I believe, suppressing the information, whether they're doing it consciously or unconsciously, or just because they need a job and they don't want to lose their job is another matter. But the similarities are there, and there's no denying them. And the fact that the Victorian era scholars addressed them and looked at the similarities and talked about the similarities, and not only that, but believed that there was a mother culture because of the similarities, and now scholars are completely silent about it and won't even discuss it, there's something fishy there, man. Yeah. And there's something that needs to be attacked. And I'm, you know, doing the best I can to attack it.
Now, we had an interesting, well, pause, shall we say, in human history when things begin to fall apart almost completely. The so-called Dark Ages, the bubonic plague, starvation, loss of knowledge. And I want to kind of get your take on how you think that this happened and what part of this that you consider to be a conspiracy to I guess suppress mankind, and the fact that there seems to be a kind of a reboot in history, even the fact that we begin over with the birth of Christ at zero is an obvious sign of this, that someone wants to push the reset button right here. And they've done this, in my view, very, very, very cleverly, with the aid of taking away this knowledge and also at the same time demonizing much of this ancient knowledge and calling it witchcraft. And we've had a tremendous suppression of so many different people and their teachings after that. How did this happen, do you think?
Yeah, me and you were right on the same page there. You know, you have, it's very simple. I see it as being very simple. You know, you have flourishing civilizations in Europe. You know, you have really, really flourishing civilizations. You know, all of a sudden you have Christianity and boom, you know, you're in the Dark Ages. And they didn't just last for a century or two. They lasted for quite a while. I think that what happened was the concept, you know, of Christianity is they tweaked it slightly, but when they tweaked it, they took away the entire meaning. And all you really have to do with Christianity to make sense of it, or at least this is, you know, for me, I'm not preaching to anybody. This is just my own, you know, my own view, and this has helped me a lot. Is you know. There isn't a Jesus, there isn't that guy over there that you should worship and ask for his help and talk about him. You know, that's where we've gone wrong. We all have a Christ within. We all have a Buddha within. We all have that God self, that higher S self. We all have that eternal soul within. And I just used a lot of different words to describe it, and it's your source. You know, it's the Christ within, it's the God within, it's the higher self within, it's the real you, the part of you that was never born and that will never die. That's your Christ self. Now, Jesus was one guy who found his Christ self, just like Buddha found his Buddha nature. He's the one who woke up, the one who awakened to his Buddha nature. Jesus is the one who awakened to his Christ nature. And the message that the ancients knew that we no longer have today is this is in everybody. It's not just for Jesus and it's not just for that guy named Buddha. It's all of us. We must all awaken to our true inner self, which is who we really are. And when we do that, life takes on a whole new meaning. And so the idea was to take that away from people and to tell them, listen, you don't have a soul. You don't have a Christ nature. In order for you to reach the transcendent, you need to come through us, and we're the church. And that's a really powerful way to scare the hell out of people and to make them follow you and to make them listen to everything you say. Because the other alternative is they teach you that you'll go to hell and you'll burn for the rest of eternity. And people really believe that. They believe that if they were outlawed from the church and they didn't follow the teachings of the church and they didn't follow Jesus, that they would be cast down to eternity into hell for the rest of eternity, and they would burn forever. And that's the way that they gained dominion and control over pretty much all of Europe, and then later that spread to you know, North and South America, and it's still happening today. And I still get emails all the time from Christians telling me why you're on the wrong track and this type of stuff. And hey, I'm not trying to take away anybody's religion. I'm just explaining what my path is, what I see for myself. And a lot of people are responding to that and saying that they feel the same thing.
And then we have an interesting period here as well. And I mean, there's debate even obviously when exactly to place the Dark Ages, how much you include of that. Some bring it as far back as the 6th century and all the way up to the 13th or even 15th. But then here towards, well, I guess the middle of that, then we could say, we have this period of the Gothic cathedrals, which is... As well, then, this is within the context of Christianity that this is being done, where we see, I would call it a revival of this knowledge. How do we explain that? Is that Christianity behind that? Who's behind this?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, usually scholars, and I think if you go to Wikipedia, you'll see that the explanation of the Dark Ages is from something like the 5th century to all the way up to the Renaissance in the 14th or 15th centuries. But you're exactly right. I mean, you know, the Gothic cathedrals just fell from the sky, it seems, you know, in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. And that'll change, you know, give or take, depending on who you ask, like you say.
Yep.
But all of a sudden, we have these magnificent Gothic cathedrals. And really, Gothic cathedrals are really magnificent. I've always been drawn to them ever since I'm a kid. I think everybody, you know, looking at a Gothic cathedral is in awe by them, by the look of them, by the feel, by the way they make you feel. Where did they come from? You know, how did they get to be where they are? I don't have the answers. I don't have all the answers, but I have an idea of what happened. And what seems to me is that you have this religion of Christianity that started to take hold and gain a very strong foothold, let's say around 300 AD. By 400, 500 AD, Christianity is in full swing and the Dark Ages are in full swing also, which should tell you something about, you know, the impact that Christianity has had in Europe. Probably about 500 years later is when the first Gothic cathedral started to spring up. Now, there has to be a connection then between the people who wanted to keep the ancient wisdom tradition alive and the Freemasons. Now, maybe it's true that the Freemasons started right then and there when Christianity arose. I'm not really sure. There's not really a lot of evidence of that. But what there is evidence of is that these Gothic cathedrals are sort of coming out of nowhere. And many of them have triptych facades, just like the ancient triptych temples of the Egyptians and of all these ancient cultures that, you know, Christianity arose to sort of conquer. So there's a connection there. And another thing that's interesting too is Gnosticism, Gnostics. I think that might be the missing link. The Gnostic tradition, of course, is in agreement with what I said about Christianity, about there being a Christ within. Gnosticism teaches that in order to find the eternal life, you know, what we're living in here is actually death, and the only real eternal life is the life of the transcendent that you find within. And that's sort of a negative view about it. I like to think of it a little bit along more positive terms, but the concept is there. The concept of duality is popular among the Gnostics, and there's a strong link made by scholars between the Gnostics, in early Christianity and some of the later secret societies like the Freemasons.
What do you think about the idea that, well, as I said before, in history, then it's been a lot of things have been taken away. We lose this connectivity between the cultures. Lots of knowledge overall is suppressed. It's deemed as heretical, of the devil, etc. And then, interestingly, at the same time, then we have the building of these cathedrals, or shortly thereafter, and they're using now then the same methods. Well, basically, with the triptych and many of the other architectural, magnificent properties that we used in the Gothic cathedrals in my view, then strengthen Christianity even further to a certain degree. It's like they've used the ancient knowledge, but to hardly even repackage it, but they're reselling it, but in a new context. What do you think about that idea?
I think in order for me to believe that, though, I would have to think then that the builders of the Gothic cathedrals were doing it for the purpose of enslaving the masses rather than inspiring and illuminating the masses. And I don't believe that's true. I believe that because I look at the cathedrals and I see a thing of beauty and I see something that's helped awaken me in my life and I know has awakened a lot of other people. So in order to believe that, I would have to believe that the builders of the cathedrals were actually doing it for nefarious purposes. And I don't believe that. I believe that the builders of the cathedrals were doing it because they wanted to continue the ancient wisdom tradition. They wanted there to be a way for later generations like us to understand what the ancient universal wisdom was all about. And they knew that building something as massive as a cathedral in stone would not be easily taken down. You know, if you can burn books,
Sure, yeah.
You can hide manuscripts. You can wipe out villages of people. You can destroy a lot. But bringing down Gothic cathedrals is a tough thing. And I think that they knew what they were doing. I think that the operative Freemasons, built the Gothic cathedrals. You know, on the one hand, they had to satisfy the people who commissioned them, the church. They had to create something that the church would look at and say, "Hi, you did a good job. This is a great cathedral. This is a great place of worship." And on the other hand, they had to encode the wisdom of the ages, the ancient wisdom tradition, in the architecture in such a way as not to alert anybody, any of the church leaders, mm-hmm. as to what they were doing.
Right.
So they had to balance it. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, they say, well, maybe some of the church leaders were complicit. Maybe some of the church leaders were sort of a fifth column and wanted also to preserve this wisdom in stone. And I agree with that, too. I definitely think that, there were a lot of the church leaders who understood what was happening and thought it was a great thing. And, you know, a lot of times leaders, they look at the masses and they say, oh, well, you know, we need to help them and just give them a very basic set of rules. And Christianity does that. You know, don't kill, don't steal, be nice to your fellow man. And they're not prepared yet for the higher wisdom. So they sort of turn a blind eye to it. But, you know, I see the Gothic cathedrals as being testaments in stone to the ancient universal religion, and I see them as having been built for very positive purposes and to preserve forever the ancient wisdom tradition and the concept of the triptych and the higher self versus the lower self and all that type of stuff, the balance of the opposites and you know, the reconciliation and the realization of the transcendent within us.
Certainly, some people have called them libraries in stone. And when you look at some of these buildings, I would definitely agree with that. And I just find it interesting that this kind of there is an internal struggle, I guess, within the history of Europe during this time. And that's why I'm trying to get closer to what really happened and who's in control here, in a sense. Because if we look at the Renaissance, much of the artwork that's coming out of that has biblical imagery within it, but they contained also so-called heretical themes from the Corpus, you know, Hermetica, when these ideas are begin to being brought back to life again. So it contains both, and they managed to put out new or so-called new ideas, these are ancient ideas, but have it still within the context of biblical themes. So it's kind of interesting how they pulled that off, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, look at the Last Supper, okay? Even to this day, everybody says, oh, what a magnificent, you know, piece of artwork. Da Vinci did so much for Christianity with this portrait. You have Christians all over the world who have this portrait in their dining rooms and up on the wall, and they think it's a magnificent piece of art, which it is. And most people don't realize that, you know, or at least I feel very, very strongly that it's an expression of the ancient universal religion because it has the triptych there in the background. It's a revelation of what the triptych wisdom teaches because it has Christ framed in the middle of the triptych, which teaches us that we all have that Christ within us. And this, all we have to do is find our center between opposites. And I think also, Henrik, that this is interesting too. You can also look at it and say, because in the portrait, Jesus is in front of the triptych, almost kind of like saying, it's almost kind of like Da Vinci, I think, was almost saying that the religion of Christianity is in the foreground, but if you look at the background, there's that triptych. So it's almost like saying that the Christian religion has stood in the way of the triptych religion of times past, and that you can interpret Christianity in the context of the ancient universal religion by realizing that there wasn't just one Christ, that we're all Christs, and that the goal of life is to sort of find that being within, find that higher self within, which is who we really are. So I mean that I totally agree with you. It's a balancing act, but I think it's definitely doable. And I think that looking at the Last Supper, it just tells you that, hey, it's still being done today, you know.
Indeed. I want to take a break here in a little bit, but one more thing we could briefly talk about, and then we can get into more detail about this. But the Knights Templar, basically, predecessors to the Masons, what do they bring to the table? Are they this one and the same when it comes to being part of the building of the cathedrals?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I've always kind of been turned off by the whole concept of the Knights Templars and any research involved in the Knights Templars. I know it's popular. I know a lot of people love the idea. To me, there's very little documentation about the Knights Templar. They didn't really leave buildings. They didn't really leave too much that I can actually study and sink my teeth into, like the Freemasons did, like with the Gothic cathedrals. And of course, there'll be a group of people that say, there's nothing that links the operative Freemasons to the Gothic cathedrals. And I think that's just a bunch of nonsense and hogwash, and you'll never convince me of that. But Knights Templar is not something that I would say that I have any kind of, knowledge about have done any significant amount of research into. I know a lot of people have, and I've read a lot about, I've read some about the Knights Templars, but I've never really been able to link them up in a way that I feel confident in publishing something about them, linking them to either the ancient wisdom tradition or the Freemasons.
All right, Richard, let's just talk a little bit here about your books. Then, of course, first one, Written in Stone, Decoding the Secret Masonic Religion Hidden in Gothic Cathedrals and World Architecture. That's out now and available. And then, of course, you have an upcoming one, Secret of the Circle, or The Lost Ancient Secret of the Circle. Tell us just briefly about that, and when that will be available, Richard.
Okay, I'm actually working on it right now, and the concept is really about how, if you look at the world's most ancient wisdom traditions and cultures and things like that, their most important symbols were circular. And I'll just use the Aten from Egypt, which is the circle with the dot in the center, which we talked about earlier, the sun disk with the wings and the serpents issuing. In Egypt, that's a circle. I mean, that was probably, along with the Ankh, one of their most important symbols. That's a symbol of the soul. We have the same symbol in the Aztec culture. It's the and we talked about that also. The Aztec calendar stone. It's a symbol also of the soul, and there's a lot of similarities there. Look at the Tao in China, the yin yang symbol. It's circular. And a lot of the ancient cultures in today we look at the ancient the American Indians also had a lot of circle symbols in their culture, the Chinese mandala, things like that, the mandalas that were created by different people. Look at the flag of India; it has a circular symbol on it that's very similar to the Aten. All these cultures use the same symbol, use the Aten symbol, use the sun symbol. It's a symbol of the soul. It's a symbol of the self, of the higher self, capital S self. And it also explains who we are in terms of the difference between the higher self and the lower self being the physical animal self, the body self, which is who we think we are. But the real self is the transcendent higher self within us, the spiritual self. So, the first part of the book sort of goes around the world and shows how, all of these ancient civilizations had the same circle as the, pinnacle symbol of their culture. And because they all understood that, the same wisdom tradition, which is, we're all composed of an eternal soul and God within, or Christ within, or Buddha within. And then the second part shows how the circle has been taken and used by a lot of these big corporations that today run the world, and they're being used against us. They're being used to entice us to buy their products, to entice us to be attracted to their logos, to be attracted to who they are, to find, because there's a deeper part of us when we see the circle as an unconscious part of us. When we see the circle, we identify with that, whether we realize it or not. Carl Jung called it the collective unconscious, that there's a part of every one of us that is the same. We're all human beings, and there's a memory within us of these circular symbols that we're not even aware of, because whether we've had a personal experience with them or not, it's built into our DNA, if you will, and we don't realize it, but these big corporations know it well. And if you look at pretty much all the major corporations, they use the circle either in their logos or in their advertising, and they use it in such a way. They use it in the right way, which is the explaining that the circle is symbolic of the sun, and usually having a point right in the middle of it. And so the book sort of explains that, shows the similarity of the circle in ancient civilizations, and then shows how a lot of these modern corporations have stolen this wisdom, and rather than sharing the wisdom with the masses and explaining it to us and explaining this is who you really are and this is what it's about, they're using it to control us. And we are controlled. Most of us are very severely controlled, even those of us who realize that the game is rigged and the table is tilted, even us, we're still attracted to that circle, whether we realize it or not. We're still under control because of that circle symbol.
So give us your website so our listeners know where to go to find out more, obviously, about you, your work, and pick up copies of your books, Richard.
Okay, I have, the book website is deepertruth.com, and I have a series of articles that explain the triptych and its manifestation in antiquity and in some of the modern buildings and secret societies and things like that and Gothic cathedrals. And I'm constantly updating that website. And I also have a blog website called richardcassaro.com where I pretty much talk about the triptych and a lot of other things that I find interesting, like the degree to which ancient wisdom is being suppressed. The fact that we're enslaved by these big corporations and who own and control most of the governments, and what it's all about, the big 500 families behind them or 1,000 families behind them, and pretty much anything that I find interesting and anything that I want to write about. So deepertruth.com for the book written in stone and richardcassaro.com for pretty much all things mystical, spiritual, archaeological, and ancient.
Very good. We'll have the links up on redicecreations.com as well. And then when we return after the break, we'll talk more about this corporate hijacking, if you will, of the symbolism, as Richard mentioned. I'll also ask more about Freemasonry, as it's been accused of being a network, if you will, for some of the conspirators as well. So there's more interesting points coming up here. So stay with us. We'll tune into some music right here, but we'll be right back with more.
Water on the brain and I'm losing sleep.
In the second hour coming up, we're really going to get further into Freemasonry and discuss Richard's viewpoint on what value the fraternity has today, what is really known within the ranks, and what he thinks of the allegations of the conspiracy that is said to exist in the upper ranks of the Scottish Rite. We're going to talk about the symbol of the eye above or in the triangle, Lucifer worship, and if Masonry has been infiltrated. Further into the hour, we are going to talk more about a second renaissance, knowledge, empowerment, and the importance of the internal quest, and how true spirituality has been hijacked. We proceed to discuss the significance of fulfilling one's destiny, following one's heart, doing the job, if you will, of what you've come here to do. Neglecting our true nature and our inherent talents could be very detrimental, because they would go to waste, something that could have devastating effects for mankind's ability to not only move ahead, but also to sort out many of the problems that we've created for ourselves and the bad ideas that we and our parents and their parents have allowed us to be drawn into. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's where you can find our open radio archive. We have over a year of radio programs available for you for free that you can download to your computer or mobile device, or you can stream directly from the website. If you're new to the program, or if you've been listening only for a little while, I hope you do take the opportunity to check out our full archives at the website for you as a subscriber, and that is redicemembers.com. You can search or browse our archives without having a membership so that you can see what we have available for you. A subscription is only €5 per month, and we have a few different options for you, going from 3 months up to 2 years, whatever suits you. And by the way, next on Red Ice Radio, we have John Lash for his final interview of this kind. It's going to be a big one, a controversial one, and you shouldn't miss it. 3 hours. Then we also have Richard Alan Miller, Gerald Salente, Johan Oldenkamp, Eric Karlström, G. Edward Griffin, and many, many more. Please see our upcoming guests in our radio archives, both at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back with hour two. Talk to you after the break, my friends.